Okay, I call to order the House Committee on Human Services on Friday, June 5th, 2009. I'm opening up an informational meeting on mental health redesign, invited testimony only, and we have
Richard Harris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Richard Harris, Interim Director of Addictions and Mental Health on DHS. I am very happy to be here this morning to talk with the committee about the proposed integration demonstration projects that AMH would put forward in the next biennium, and would love to talk to you a little bit. You should have a PowerPoint handout. Chair Tomei, thank you for asking us to come and talk about this integration project and the issues that go with it. As a way of introduction, I would say we've been working on this mostly out of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources and have gone through a number of meetings in the community talking with stakeholders and people in recovery and consumers and the like about how to proceed with a couple of demonstration projects. So the context for this is that there's a lot of talk about how healthcare reform is going to go forward, both at the national level and certainly with the state of Oregon, and that in a way this project is embedded in the larger issues of how we manage the care for people who have a mental illness and addictions within the larger healthcare system. So at the present time, Oregon makes considerable investments in addiction and mental health services, and it comes in a variety of different ways. It comes from the healthcare funding dollars through Medicaid and state match in the Oregon Health Plan. It comes through general fund where it's appropriated to specifically deal with addiction and mental health issues. And it comes from federal sources in block grants and special other special grants for specific services. And a lot of it comes from the communities themselves and the programs in the counties where the services are being provided. They also bring many resources to the table. So there are multiple funding sources and multiple agencies and multiple entities that all have some responsibility for addictions and mental health services. So the last legislature actually commissioned a couple of studies to be done that were aimed at getting a better understanding of how mental health and addiction services were being funded and provided. And those reports, the public consulting group report called the PCG report, and I believe we talked about it in this committee earlier on in the session. There was a second study that was done around the delivery of addiction services, known as the Human Services Research Institute, or the HSRI report. And those two reports had many things in common in terms of suggested changes and things that could improve the mental health and addictions delivery system. So we took that as a starting place to start talking about, okay, how would you create a system that had more efficient use of management of the dollars in the system? How could you create a system that integrated mental health addictions with health care? And several months ago, at the direction of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, were asked to bring forward a concept, which we did. That concept was discussed and the Ways and Means Committee, and we were given some direction about moving forward in the community with some discussion with stakeholders about how to proceed. So the report PowerPoint that you have here is, in a way, condensed out of some of the earlier work that was done, and what I'd hope to do is go through some of the highlights to this, and then at the end sort of come up and talk a little bit about what our next steps would be. So if you go to the page 2, the guiding principles, when we started out with the concept, these were the principles that were used to give us guidance about what were the important things that needed to be addressed if we were going to deal with the issues that were raised in the HSRI report and the PCG report. And I think that some of these I just want to outline a little more, and that is that the goal of treatment and recovery really is to provide opportunities for people to become self-sufficient. We've talked about in this committee before about how important it is that people get to the place where they recognize that the problems they have are lifelong, that just like with diabetes, there are ways to manage it, but in fact, you have to take into consideration diet and exercise, and the way you manage your life is important to the outcome of the disease. And that's very true for addictions and for mental health illnesses as well, is that it's not likely to go away and never come back again. It's something that needs to be managed. So a recovery model is the appropriate way to look at these kinds of health problems moving forward. And that we understand that from experiences of many programs around the state of Oregon where mental health, and addiction services are being delivered in an integrated fashion, about why that is a superior model to the idea that you go one place for addiction services and your health care is being taken care of somewhere else. And I don't mean just in the locations, but in the systems themselves. And what we know now in addictions and mental health is that there are huge health disparities amongst people who have addiction problems and who have mental illness, and that their lives are shortened by the conditions that prevail in their addictions or mental health, and they really need care, a full holistic care system that addresses both the issues of mental illness or health care at the same time. And that's one of the aims of these demonstrations, is to show how integrated service delivery systems address these issues in a better way and get better outcomes. We know on the funding side that multiple funding sources all have their own rules and regulations, and it becomes rather chaotic in trying to manage the integrated services if you have multiple and different agencies managing your funds. And so there's an effort here to try to consolidate the funding sources so that it simplifies the finance mechanisms that would bring us an integrated care. Another element in this that I think is important to understand is that in our rather chaotic funding system we have now, we don't have a way to attach payment for measurable outcomes. And this is being done in a variety of places around the country. People are learning to be more sophisticated about this, but it certainly is likely to be a much more effective use of funds if, in fact, what you're paying for is the outcomes. You're not gearing your funding system to pay for the inputs to the treatment services. So we think that in a demonstration project, we need to be following the principles in this outline here. On slide 3, after a lot of discussion with stakeholders and with the Ways and Means Committee, we've recommended that there be 2 or maybe 3 demonstration projects around the state using programs, counties, funding mechanisms, and management mechanisms that are currently in place, and bringing them together into a unified and integrated management system. There are a lot of programs throughout the state of Oregon that are delivering integrated services. But there are no programs around that are delivering them with integrated funding. And part of that goes back to the original design in Oregon Health Plan about how addiction services and mental health services were to be paid for, and they're being paid for in two different systems, and the effort here would to bring those into one payment system. So the projects really would be those communities who already have had some experience with integrated delivery system or integrated service system that would then move to an integrated management and finance system. So that would consolidate funding. A lot of the change that will have to take place here is change with the Department of Human Services and how we manage both general fund, beer and wine tax money, and the federal Medicaid funds, because those are funnels into the programs that we have some control over, and we need to bring our thinking together about how we manage these in a more integrated way. Moving to slide 4, I've already talked a little bit about this, and that is that the reason for doing this, because of some earlier reports about suggested changes, as well as trying to manage the system in a way that we ultimately move to right-sizing the system. We're very heavily invested in Oregon in institutional mental health care, whether it's in the community or at the state hospital. So a large portion of our funds, 58%, roughly goes to about 12% of the population. We think that means that we're spending money in higher cost elements of service and serving fewer people, and if we were to better manage those funds, we'd get more services in the community and be able to serve more people. And I think that's the intent here, is to find the ways to do that. A demonstration project should help us understand how to do that better. And that's in a context we know that we're not meeting the total needs of Oregonians when it comes either to mental health or addiction services. We're way behind. So someplace around 24% of the need for addiction services are currently being met in the system, and that's not good enough. We need to make a system that it's able to serve more people that need these services. But we're in a financially restricted environment, and I could and would say to you, of course we need to make more investments in these services, but given the economic times, it's not likely to happen in the near future. So in the meantime, we need to be working on getting as efficient as we can possibly be. So it's getting better services.
We have a question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard, you mentioned here on slide number 4 that you're only serving 24% of the people right now with substance or disorder. Do you have an outcome measurement that you've designed already, what the percentage you would like to be at?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, in the demonstration projects, we haven't set the outcome measurements to this point. We will, in fact, look at the demonstrations to see roughly what the population was before we started and how many people we were able to serve afterwards. That's important to know. Are we getting more people through the front door? But we know we haven't set that measurement yet. We've looked at the class of kinds of measurements to make, but we haven't set the actual measurement yet.
Okay, a follow-up, Madam Chair. From the old agency that I used to work with, and when we ended up not getting the funding, we still went out and worked extremely hard to try to still meet the demand that the public expected from us and to even exceed that. Have you given much thought about, I know that the dollars are being really restricted for you right now with the way things are. Are there things that you're doing to think outside the box to exceed where you're at right now with this 24%?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, the purpose of the demonstrations is to show how the delivery system, if it were integrated, can achieve some efficiencies that would include serving more individuals in the same funding realm by using the funds in a different way so that you maximize the use through better utilization, through incentive payments for outcomes, So those mechanisms need to show that you can serve a population of people better and you can serve more people through the front door. So that's the intent. In the demonstrations themselves, you know, we may be covering a small part of the state, so it's not likely until there's more systematic change to make those kinds of inroads into the larger 24%, say, moving that to 30%. My belief is that the pathway will be revealed through these demonstrations about how we can get there to serve more people. But for the individual projects, that will be part of the measurement.
Okay, thanks.
And Richard, in the demonstration projects, how large a population are you looking at? Are you looking at a whole county? Are you looking at a portion of a county?
Chair Tomei, the intent of the demonstrations is to try to cover geographical areas, not to focus on individual programs or, for that matter, individual counties, but to look at more regional approaches to this. It depends upon, because another factor in doing these demonstrations is that we're going to do the demonstrations with willing partners, and it, to some degree, it depends upon what is out there in the community and programs that want to come forward. So it's possible that there would be one that might focus on a county only, and there may be, because the way mental health funding goes through mental health managed organizations is that they generally include regions like Mid-Willamette Valley Behavioral Health or Jefferson Health Delivery, so that you have the possibilities of doing more regional approaches, and that would be my preference, but it depends upon what groups come forward from the community to say, we want to integrate these things and we want to be part of the demonstration projects.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, and I want to allow you to get back on track here, but very important to me is that we be open as we get reports from these pilot projects, that we may not be seeing the same kind of percentages broken out by treating people with mental illness and the percentage of people being treated around a substance disorder, because to me the most important thing you said was that around the desire to integrate addictions and mental health payment systems so that we are no longer breaking people out in these two categories, because we understand the crossover and the challenges that we have been trying to address with dual diagnosis, and that's something that the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Programs has addressed a number of times, and the challenges of the providers to have to classify an individual in order to get into the right payment structure. So I just want to throw out that as we look at outcomes, we may not be seeing comparative numbers to what we have right now and what we have as programs are more successful, because we may be counting things differently.
Good point. Talk some about dual diagnosis among this population that you're hoping to be treating.
Chair Tomei, I think the answer to the question about dual diagnosis needs to be seen through the lens of a holistic approach to the way we see people. Many people that we're currently seeing either in the mental health system or the addiction system, and in many communities seen in an integrated system where that it doesn't really matter so much what the diagnosis is, it's what the needs are, but that we need to see that when people come for treatment, the presenting problem may be different from the underlying issues that are there. And the one thing we have been learning recently is how healthcare problems are current in people with mental health and addiction issues. And if you can't address those simultaneously, then, in fact, what you're doing is sort of only doing one leg of the stool, and the whole thing is less successful because people don't have an opportunity to do that. I know that in my old agency at Central City Concern, it took years to integrate the primary care clinic with the addiction and the mental health. It wasn't as easy as you snapped your fingers and, you know, everybody just lined up and said, oh, we want to do integration, because the providers aren't used to the idea that they have to look at all of these elements at the same time. So I think it's less now about are you dual diagnosed, as what are the issues that you need to address in order to improve your life. And it may be that you need dental care because as a person with methamphetamine problems, it attacks the dental system, and people have really awful oral health. If they don't solve that, they're going to be unsuccessful in getting jobs and in managing their lives. So the whole idea here is to just look at what the total needs are for people when they walk through the door. And that means our health care system has to be much better at identifying those issues around addictions that normally they don't necessarily ask the right questions about when people come to the clinic. So I know that in the Old Town Clinic at Central City, after you got clinicians trained in asking the right questions and doing the universal assessment about, you know, how people are dealing with their addictions, you all of a sudden discover that addictions are a much larger issue than the healthcare providers thought they were before. If you have an integrated system, then those individuals are more easily helped into the necessary other treatment services. So there's a greater understanding that there's multi-diagnosed individuals with a myriad of problems here. You just need to address in some priority fashion all of those conditions.
I feel our time is running out, and I'm really on, I don't know, page five or whatever, but I'm so fascinated by this whole process, and I have lots of questions, so I'm being the chair, I'm asking them.
I would be more than happy to spend whatever time you think is necessary to talk about this. We can certainly do it in your office at some point.
Great, but I, as we talk about integrating services, we're not just talking about mental health and health and dental health, et cetera. We're also talking about jobs and housing. You sort of hit on that earlier, and you've said in the past that one of the issues that you want to see addressed is making sure that people have a key to their home, that we're wanting to get people out of institutions, and not just from a big institution to a smaller institution, but into a place where they've got a key to their home.
Yeah.
So how talk to us some about how you see integrating all of these together in these demonstration projects.
Well, Chair Tomei,
I'm going to stop you just a minute. Somebody has a cell phone on. Please take out your cell phones and your Blackberries. Everybody, take them out of your purses and out of your pockets. Please take them out. And Richard, you too. And
I did turn mine off, but it's...
They have to be turned off, not just on mute. Please turn them off. And what happens is that they affect the sound system.
It's
somebody
off.
Did it right. Terrific. Thank you. Okay.
I may have been the guilty party.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I was just a little distracted. What was
okay? So my question is we're talking about integrating all of these services, mental health, and housing, and jobs, and wraparound services. So talk to us some about how you intend to be doing that in these demonstration projects.
Chair Tomei, thank you for that question. The intention to start out with is not to try to create an integrated mechanism from scratch. So if a community doesn't have basic elements already functioning together, doing that process will take several years to bring all of those service elements and line them up. So our intention is to work with communities that have some experience with integration. Now, because integration is much more complex than I think most people understand, just the way health services are delivered is right now the subject of how are we going to change that to work better. So we'd focus on those likely communities that have already had some experience with this, and then look for ways, because they are aware of where the deficiencies are in their integrated system, how they would bring those closer in alignment so that we're not working from scratch, we're working with communities that have done this. So, for example, the Benton County Health Department, Mitch's program is a good example of an integrated delivery model already. So you'd want to work with programs like that that have an expertise in this, are connected to healthcare, connected to addictions, connected to mental health. But it may be, see, none of the funding sources are connected this way, and the management is also not consolidated. So, but there are many components in an integrated model that would get better outcomes if you added those components into the system. But right now, they're not seen as service elements. So peer-delivered services, for instance. We know that peer-delivered transitional services are very effective, helping people move from one element of service to another. You would save resources if you integrated peer services into a system which may already have health care, but people are, in the mental health side, are baffled by getting through the health care system, and you have somebody who, navigator or a peer mentor, who helps people through that system, then they use the resources more effectively because they're not shunted off to some place where they're not going to get their treatments. So I think the idea here is to fill in the missing chunks or places in communities that already have some integrated services going on to improve the way the services are done in that community.
Great. Richard, we don't have a whole lot of time. Could you just sort of maybe wrap it up?
Okay.
And then, colleagues, the reason I'd ask Mr. Harris to come here was that in the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Human Services, we did pass legislation that is going to provide funding for these two or three pilot projects. So we heard about it in Ways and Means. And being the policy committee, I think it's important for us to be hearing about these issues and following up on this as these pilot projects progress through the system. So I want us to sort of have some basic understanding of what will be happening, and then we'll be following up with Mr. Harris through the next, I'm assuming this is going to take several years to be doing this, and I want to make sure that we have some information so that we can have some knowledge and know what is going on here. So I'm sorry if I seem to have dominated this. Usually I try not to do that.
No, Madam Chair, we're getting used to it.
Okay, Richard.
Chair Tomei, committee members, I think just in summary, where we're at right now is that as we're coming down to the closure of the session, that Ways and Means Subcommittee has asked for a budget note to give us some direction about going forward with this. We submitted a budget note that was lengthier than the co-chairs wanted, and so we have now a budget note that is much shorter, and I believe it's in the hands of the co-chairs now, and they will at some point forward it to the full Ways and Means Committee, and that will give us the direction to go forward with the pilot projects. And what I've said to the co-chairs is that we'll, as our guiding light, we'll use the longer document that was fashioned by AMH with the help of the mental health directors about going forward in, but we'll ask for the budget note, and then we'll move on in this next biennium to proceed with the projects.
Great, thanks. And I hope that as you move along that you send our committee staff, well, it might not be Keeley, I'm sorry to say, but send our committee staff updates on how you're moving along with this so that as we have hearings through the interim and next session, that we'll know how you're proceeding, and we will be very interested in seeing how
we would be glad to do that.
Terrific. Any final questions, colleagues? All right. Thank you again, Richard.
Thank you.
Hope to see you in the near future. Okay. We're going to close the informational hearing on mental health redesign. And I'm sorry that Representative Maurer wasn't here. I know this is a special interest of his, and we'll have to bring him up to date on this. We're going to open up an informational hearing on the state hospital update. Roy Orr, good to see you, Roy. Well, you have lots of material here.
I'll try and cover it quickly, Chair Tobin.
Thank you. You've had a tough job, and we appreciate the hard work you've put into this.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Roy Orr. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. I'm grateful to have the opportunity to share much of the work that's been going on at the state hospital in a little over a year that I've been there. Many of our challenges are well-publicized and deeply ingrained in the organization, as you folks are very well aware. I'm deeply gratified at the end of approximately 15 months with the support throughout the organization that I've received, and let me also say for the record that many of the changes that have occurred there were in fact underway before I arrived. I want to make sure that the staff that was in place there gets the credit that they're due. I would like to just, if with your permission, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, just move rather quickly through the handout that I hope you all have in front of you and answer questions along the way or at the end, whichever works for you. And with your direction, Chair Tomei, I have steered a lot of this information toward our response to the USDOJ's visit, which you'll all recall occurred back late in 2006 and became public with a letter of findings to the governor that arrived in January of 2008. And as I said, I'm pleased with much of the progress that we've made here, and I have a lot to tell you, so I'll...
Okay, I'm not sure that our newer members may have know. Do you know to what he's referring, Representative?
Some of the items, but not complete, no.
Michael?
Okay. Just some.
Well, Mike, why don't you just give a brief overview of what that was about and what the threat was for the state and the hospital?
In November of 2006, the United States Department of Justice, the Civil Rights for Institutionalized Persons Division, was made the Oregon State Hospital aware that they were of the opinion that civil rights of some of our patients were being violated, and arranged a time to come out and survey the hospital and bring a team of experts to do so. The result of that survey culminated in a findings letter which was sent to the governor and arrived in the governor's office, I believe, in January of 2008. Many of those findings were related to the very old facilities within which we practice, and most particularly the extraordinarily antiquated design those buildings represent, not just the sheer age, for instance, the seismic quality of those buildings, but that they do not represent a state-of-the-art design for psychiatric, especially for people who have persistent and severe mental illness. And there were other findings about the quality of care that was delivered, findings with regard to long-standing vacancies of key positions in the delivery of mental health care, hard-to-fill positions, but regardless of that, long-standing openings. The extraordinary reliance on overtime, chronic reliance on overtime, which we all know in any business is potentially unsafe and unwise and at some level fiscally imprudent, and a heavy reliance, chronic reliance on contract staff, external, which are, while dedicated people to their profession, they're arguably not as dedicated as folks who join the organization as employees, and they're extraordinarily expensive as well. And the state hospital had created, and I'll refer to this several times in my presentation, a continuous improvement plan, a comprehensive plan that's almost 250 pages in length and includes 188 areas of work that grew to that size as a result of the letter of findings that went to the governor back in January of 08. We have adopted that continuous improvement plan, or CIP, as our roadmap and our self-governing, self-guiding roadmap toward a very, very different future, and with the legislature's leadership to allow us to to add actually to our employee ranks. I sat here 15 months into the position, very heartened that we've been able to make significant progress on many of the things that were outlined in their report. I had planned to mention this later in my report, but since we're talking about the USDOJ at the beginning, let me, from an administrator or a layperson's perspective, tell you that in the ensuing time that I've been here, we have, through the Oregon Attorney General's office, been in contact with the USDOJ over settlement discussions, as opposed to being sued in federal court by the Civil Rights Division of the USDOJ. And that's something we'd very much like to avoid. We have experts on board who have worked either side of this sort of relationship in other states as consultants to the state hospitals or as consultants to the USDOJ Civil Rights Division, Drs. Geller and McLaughlin. They are an extraordinary help to us with the very rare, if not unique, knowledge that they embody. And they can give us and have given us firsthand knowledge of what other states, let me cite, for example, Hawaii. Hawaii was, in fact, sued in federal court. And as a result of that, they came under the consent decree of the court. And at that point, we lose control of the hospital in many ways in the court, in that the court really tells us how many positions to hire, what the ratios of patients to those positions are, and that's a position we don't want to find ourselves in. Those conversations have been attorney-client privileged, of course, but have been going back and forth between the Oregon DOJ and the USDOJ. And just very, very recently, we learned that since it's been almost 2 years now since the USDOJ was out here, that they intend to come back out at the end of July and resurvey the hospital. I personally welcome that opportunity because of the strides that we have made. I am absolutely confident they will find a very different hospital. They will find, physically speaking, they'll find parts of the hospital being demolished as we make good on the promise to create the facilities that the legislature has funded. So not having been here in November of 2006 when the first survey took place, I personally really welcome the opportunity to interact with the USDOJ when they're out here at the end of July. And we're just now beginning. In fact, this afternoon we have one of our first planning meetings in preparation for their return. So I hope I didn't provide too much information there. Is that helpful?
It does.
Yes. Thank you.
I'll move relatively swiftly through this out of respect for your time and your agenda today. I'm happy to be stopped at any point along the way. The first page inside your handout simply points out the three major themes, which I've already touched on as a result of the USDOJ's visit here. Need to improve quality of care. I'll talk about that throughout the remaining slides. The need to do a better job of hiring and in fact to have more positions if we can overcome the stigma and the problems, the challenges that we've had historically of filling positions, which I'm happy to report further on in this that we've been able to do. And, of course, to give the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project, which I'm sure you're all aware has a separate administrator, Ms. Linda Hammond, who's done an extraordinary job on our behalf of interfacing with our staff and helping us design what will be, and I'm not fond of the phrase state-of-the-art, because about the time you utter that last consonant, you're no longer state-of-the-art, but what will be a purpose-built and really an exceptional facility, which we will replicate in some smaller scale, is yet to be determined in Junction City. We are continuing to hire. The emphasis has been on hard-to-fill positions. Everyone's aware of the difficulty of filling healthcare and hard-to-fill positions these days, particularly nurses and physicians. We've done an extraordinary job in that regard. We'll talk about that later. I already mentioned our long-term reliance on overtime and contract staff, which we want to get a handle on and are, in fact, in the process of getting a handle on. I'll turn to page 3. There's a overall description of our services. I would point out just two things in that verbiage, that patients in almost every instance come to the Oregon State Hospital through the courts, either through having been civilly committed or criminally committed. And also mentioned that currently, at least, Blue Mountain Recovery Center in Pendleton is also a part of the Oregon State Hospital system. On page 4, this is a bed breakdown by service. You'll see that we have 144 beds in Salem and 92 in Portland. The 92 in Portland are in leased space. We leased that space in the old Holiday Park facility from Legacy. They continue to occupy part of that building. The far and away, the majority of the patients in Portland are civilly committed patients. Within the civilly committed population, we have geriatric and neuropsychiatric patients. And in fact, we have no adolescent or child programs at the state hospital. All of our services are adult services. The bottom bullet there is our forensic psychiatric services. You can see the lion's share of our services are, in fact, of a forensic nature. The last sub-bullet under forensic there, I might just point out, is where we refer to the cottages, the 6 cottages, which we would be pleased to have the opportunity to give any of you a tour of. I think Representative Tomei has been out.
I haven't been in the cottage, but I want to go.
These are actually the very first phase of the replacement project. This is where many of our transitional patients who have successfully moved down the continuum of recovery and are now ready to reenter the community and have moved outside the secure perimeter. These cottages do all have secured systems on windows and doors. They're staffed 24/7, but they do represent the first phase, actually, of our replacement project. The fifth slide is the beginning of some of the improvements that we've made, adhering to our continuous improvement plan. The centralized treatment model we've talked quite a bit about. Briefly, one of the findings of the United States Department of Justice was that we were not providing enough active treatment. Active treatment being very specifically tailored to the treatment plan and the mental illness and any peripheral problems that the patient may have, as opposed to our providing leisure skills or lifetime sort of skills, life skills. And the threshold is acceptable to the USDOJ is that we strive for and ultimately provide 20 hours in the course of a week to every patient of active treatment. We're making significant progress in that direction. The most efficient way to achieve that threshold is to congregate patients in a centralized area, not unlike the way we do education, high school or college for that matter. So we're creating treatment malls or treatment halls where patients will congregate, and there will be classrooms in those malls that will provide active treatment to small groups, large groups. Our first treatment mall actually was built on the Portland campus and has been in operation a couple of years now. The entire new hospital replacement project will be built on this concept. So we're actually learning how to migrate from the residential halls to the centralized treatment areas and some of the challenges of moving patients back and forth before we actually occupy the new facility. Our second mall that was created was our mall for our geriatric patients and neurologically impaired patients. And most recently, we opened a transitional mall in our 40 building on campus. We're currently serving at least 200 of our patients through these treatment malls. And we have a mall that's being built in our 50 building for our forensic patients, which will be open later in the fall.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cohen.
Might you just very quickly give one or two examples of what's going on at the treatment mall on any given day?
They truly, Representative Cowan, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, they're truly very much like a collegiate environment. We have a central gathering area where we can socialize with the patients, have coffee, get ready for the classes that ensue. The perimeter of the malls are classrooms of different sizes where we have our psychology staff, our social services staff, our recreational staff, nursing staff, actually teaching classes.
Classes
that tie directly to the diagnosis, anger management, behavioral sort of classes, those
Thank
kinds
you.
Of things. Very much active treatment.
I just wanted to build a picture in my
uh-huh.
mind. Thank
uh-huh.
you.
Our goal will be to serve 600 of our patients by June of 2011 in these interim malls. So our history has been to provide all services on the residential units. If we were to build a hospital, a replacement hospital built on that model, it would be extraordinarily more expensive not only to build, but it would be extraordinarily expensive to staff. By congregating patients, we have a much more efficient design. Page 6, I'll move a little quicker, but again, feel free to interrupt me as you wish. We are expanding the number of consumers that are involved in our treatment programs, and one of our programs that we have recently developed is a peer bridger program. These are trained consumers who join our staff or employed by us, who engage in the treatment of our patients and actually role model the ability to move through the system and to live in the community independently and work successfully in the community and help our patients actually bridge to the community successfully and follow them thereafter. This is actually patterned after a program that was developed in New York State. And it's relatively new to us, but the early signs are it's a very successful program, and we believe it will help a lot of our patients overcome the anxieties of returning to the community and shorten their length of stay at the hospital. Metabolic disorders program was another area of the USDOJ where we were criticized for not attending to the medical needs sufficiently of our patients. Metabolic disorders, a key one would be, for instance, diabetes. And we have hired a physician who will join our staff in late summer or early fall, and that position's now been filled, and we're doing a much better job in that regard. Page 7, recovery is an important tenet of what we do. And needs to become an important cornerstone in the culture of our organization. There are basically 10 tenets that support recovery, and in order for our staff and the culture throughout our staff to begin to embrace recovery, we've started with 30 focus groups. Not quite half of our employees participated in those focus groups, and we now have a work group that's been established that will begin to make recovery an important part of the culture of our organization. Treatment care planning, another area of criticism by the USDOJ, and one that we've formalized. We've created a master treatment care plan template. We're creating an electronic version of that so we can roll that out to all of the treatment units and have a consistent approach to treatment care planning throughout the organization. On slide 8, talk a little bit about our efforts to hire physicians, certainly, and all classifications are difficult to fill positions. I'm pleased to say that by September of this year, we may have, in fact, all of our ward positions filled with full-time physicians or part-time physicians, but employed physicians. We have succeeded very well in taking some different approaches in terms of recruiting and advertising. The economy may have been, in a perverse sort of way, a help to us, but be that as it may, very few people, if any, can remember when Oregon State Hospital was fully staffed with regard to physician positions. The chief medical officer position has been vacant for approximately 2 years, and frankly, for closer to 7 or 8 years, has not been occupied on a full-time basis by anyone. It's either been interim or part-time, and I'm pleased to say that we've had some excellent candidates for the CMO position, and we'll be announcing next week that position has been filled and will be occupied this summer. Registered nurses, barely needs to be mentioned how difficult nurses are to find and hire these days, especially those that subspecialize in an area like mental health. I'll talk a little bit about this later, but we went through a lean leader process to make a much leaner and faster cycle time for our interviewing and eventual offers to nurses. That has reduced vacancies at the state hospital from 24% vacant to 5%. And that's just happened within the last year or so. In fact, if you went back further than a year, the vacancies were as high as 30% out there, which resulted in a lot of overtime and contract staff. The Acuity and Security Program, or ASP as we call it, it bears mentioning because of a partnership that we were able to create with SEIU in hiring the staff into these positions, basically as certified nursing assistants, but to deploy them in a very targeted sort of way to help us reduce the assaults and behavioral management throughout our campus. And we're grateful to SEIU for working with us in that regard. We hired 51 of these positions, and they've reduced assaults on our campus dramatically. The direct care staff, who are the line staff, if you will, on the treatment units, mental health therapists and mental health therapy techs, we've actually hired 230 of those, and that's a net number, even with attrition. Over the little more than the last year, we've hired 230 of those, and we rely heavily on MHTs and MHTTs in our care delivery. On slide 9, the transformation initiative I just alluded to, and Dr. Goldberg has brought to DHS. We welcome the opportunity to have lean leaders in the transformation initiative come to Oregon State Hospital. As you can see there, we reduced our RN cycle time, and we have significantly reduced the use of agency and contract nurses, which has been a help to us. Dietary consultations, attending to the nutritional needs of our patients. The number of consults that we're able to do now because of a lean leader or rapid process improvement that was focused on dietary consultations, the increase has really been remarkable. And the referral times to actually evaluating patients decreased from months to a week.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up a little bit. We have about 5 or 6 more minutes. So the next slide is, I think, a very important one. We need to touch on that one for sure.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I appreciate that. Maybe I should have put it earlier in the presentation, but we were severely criticized by the U.S. DOJ for our use of restraints for our patients, our assaultive patients in particular, and the use of seclusion. Both were almost 5 times the national average as late as 2007. We've reduced those 75% and 80% respectively. More importantly, they are at or below the national averages in both categories now, and they continue. In fact, just got results for the last quarter in on my BlackBerry before you reminded me to shut it off, Chair Tomei, that we remain in the last quarter below, at or below the national averages.
That's terrific.
Also, reducing falls, having a safer environment was an area that we emphasized as well. I would also, if I may, touch on the next slide. Those of you familiar with the world of hospitals, whether it's a state hospital or any other hospital in the country, are probably familiar with the Joint Commission, historically known as the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. Our last survey in 2006 did not go very well. They came back to survey us in February, and we went from having 19 serious findings back in 2006 to having only 4 findings back in February and full accreditation, and we're pleased. It's a neutral third party, and in fact, if you will, a gold standard for how hospitals operate, opinion on the changes I think the staff have made at the state hospital. We're fully accredited and certified by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and there you have also a reference again to the U.S. DOJ. I'll stop there in light of your schedule and other things you have on your agenda and see if you have any questions for me.
Talk just briefly about the new state hospital and how that's progressing.
I can't express enough appreciation not only for the work that the replacement project group has done under Linda Hammond's direction, but also the appreciation to not have that on my plate as a priority, to be very candid. It has afforded me and the staff of our hospital the opportunity to really focus on these issues, which are critical to all of us. They have participated actively in the research around the country of similar facilities, again, work that we didn't need to do. They've worked extraordinarily well with neighborhood groups and the Historical Society. And are delivering and will deliver, I think, a project and a facility that we can all be very proud of.
That's great, Roy. Representative Dimroe.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Roy, I'm very pleased to hear about the reduction in the seclusion and restraints. I'm wondering, though, if it's creating any problems for staff, for, you know, the safety, for the physical well-being of staff who are working with the population.
Representative Dimroe, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent point. We in fact had a significant spike in assaultive activity in 2009 as a result of seclusion and restraint coming down. We feel that was due to two activities, really. Not only the fact that we weren't restraining as quickly or secluding patients as quickly, and therefore putting staff in some respects in harm's way, but we have a vastly improved incident reporting system, whether it's slips and falls or back strains or assaults from patients. So thanks to our policy analysis and research staff that we now have, we were able to dive into those statistics, and we determined that the majority of it was a result of better reporting, and that in fact, if there's a litmus test for the assaults, it would probably be in the lost time work from serious assaults or medical claims in volume or by dollar size. And in fact, all in those two categories, we were at 6-year lows. So let me also say I would not for a moment want to minimize an assault on any of our staff or on any vulnerable patient from another patient. But the first quarter information we have from 2009 would bear out that our staff have regained the skills of engaging patients and not being as assaulted as they were in 2009, because it looks like we're off to a year where we'll have assaults at maybe an all-time low, and lost time from work and medical costs at all-time lows.
Thank you.
Any other quick questions? Colleen, there was, for those of us who were here a year and a half ago when this report from the U.S. DOJ came out, caused a great deal of angst, not only in this building but throughout the state, so that Mr. Orr has been able to move this ship in a different direction, I think, is remarkable. So we owe them a debt of thanks, and we'll be following your progress in the future. We'll be hearing more. And I would encourage us to come and visit the hospital. See, I visited the hospital in the past, but I haven't recently. So I'd like, and maybe we can do that as a committee, maybe even as our session winds down, we might find time to go over there as a group.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think a visit to the cottages would be a real step up from my last walk through the old J building. Which is still
depressing.
Right there in my memory.
Right.
Now. I'd love to go to some of the newer places.
We'll see what we can do to arrange that.
Chair Tomei, yes. Thank you for your kind words on behalf of the staff.
Oh, and please extend our gratitude to them also.
Thank you.
Any quick questions? Thank you so much for coming
today.
Thank you. And I'll close the informational hearing on the State Hospital update and open up an informational hearing on Work Incentives Network Program. Where did the good representative go? Is he there? Where is he? He walked out. See, that is so typical of him.
No. Get him quick before he really gets beaten up.
Okay. Do we have? Okay, come on up, Sherry.
Chair Tomei and committee, my name is Sherry Stock, Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and I am work with the WIN project and work with the people that participate in it. So I'm going to give a brief overview. I have a PowerPoint. You all got a packet, and I'm going to talk about that in just a minute.
Okay.
You coming up?
Quickly.
The disappearing representative.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm really glad that he's not a member of this committee any longer.
Oh. You can't be sorry you asked me.
You start.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm sorry I'm a little late. I was in the Speaker's office, and it took him a little longer to get security than it usually does to get me out. See, it's a joke. For the record, George Gilman, District 39, Vic Gilliam, District 18, and Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you lifting the ban on me coming to your committee just for this special occasion. But
we do have security right out the door.
I understand. I'm going to kick this off quickly. I don't have a lot to add, but as you know, that's never stopped me from speaking before. But you're going to hear from some wonderful Oregonians who are working very hard, not only to overcome personal hardship, but also to sometimes overcome our own government bureaucratic nightmare that we create. We don't create it intentionally. One legislative session goes to another, and we are trying to help those most vulnerable in our state, and sometimes we don't realize that by creating a safety net, we can create a web that they get caught in. You're going to hear from folks that are in the WIN program and some others who are trying to both use the assistance that they both deserve and need to move forward with their lives and not to become stuck in a situation where they are somehow dependent on the state or others. They're great stories. They're from all over the state. And I think you're going to enjoy it. I think that there's one thing we can agree on, and that is we want to help people to help themselves. And government programs can actually do that instead of hindering them. So we can move from a feeling of fear that we might lose benefits over here if we somehow take advantage of benefits over there to a situation where we are coordinating and moving people along that really have great stories to tell and who want to succeed and have succeeded. So I'm just here to say I'm all for it. I appreciate very much this committee listening, and I think you're going to enjoy my constituent, Sherry Stock. I always do. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Sherry, I want to point out we have 25 minutes, and I'm going to let you police the time, okay?
And we'll be right on time.
Terrific.
So in your packet is the PowerPoint, and I am also, do you control the computer or do I? And so this is an inspiring quote from a Wynn client who gave us permission to use it, and it shows what the program can do for people with disabilities and for the state of Oregon. In addition to the fact that this woman has a life she can be proud of, she went from being homeless to bringing tax revenue into the state as a result of this program. And for people that maybe will have a problem reading it, it says, "Before when I did not know the rules for working with benefits and lost my benefits and my job. This left me broke and I lost my housing and ended up living in a storage unit. Since then, I was afraid to try to work again since I did not know the rules. Now I have been working part-time since January and I'm getting out of debt. I have a stable home and self-esteem. I have hope for the future now. Thank you. Thank you, Wynn," by Stephanie Thompson. One of the major concerns for low-income people with disabilities is considering employment is how to keep or get their health care and other critical needs met. Wynn is a free service that gives just that. There are many different and extremely complex state and federal work incentives programs that all affect each other. This is not only confusing to the people with disabilities, but can also discourage them from even trying to work. This is why the WIN program is so critical. It cuts through this maze, makes options understandable, and gives support to people through work incentive programs that were designed to help them so that they can finally use them to their and our state's advantage. This is from a recent survey that was sent out to 1,050 WIN clients. There were 203 respondents across the state. And what it shows is that 20% of the people have started working, and another 21%, so a total of 41%, but another 21% were working, and now they're making more money and working more hours. And the overwhelming majority of them either started to work or have more money and more hours than they did before. So the benefits are huge. These are two additional questions out of the eight that were asked. The first is a question number four. The information I got from Wynn helped me make a choice about work. Keep in mind that 21% of the respondents, or 43 people, were already working when they got the WIN services, so they didn't need help making a choice out of work. But 77 respondents said that the information they got from WIN helped them make a choice about work. The second set of data is from question number 7. I plan to stay in touch with WIN staff in case something changes in my work or benefits and I need more help and information. WIN is not a one-time free service. It exists as long as the client wishes. If the client goes to work for the first time and they have all their work incentives in order, and then they get a raise, a lot might change about their situation, and they need ongoing support to continue to navigate the benefits and work incentive system. WIN is housed in the Centers for Independent Living throughout the state, and as you hear from the folks that are testifying today, services cover the entire state, even the most rural, and WIN serves anyone with any type of disability. A person does not have to be receiving public, state, or federal funding to get WIN services. It's open to everyone. And this is a quote from Mike, and Mike will be talking in just a minute. And so I'm going to quickly move on and let people come up. We have in your packet, you'll see a list of all the people that are going to testify. There's people from each of your constituents will be testifying as well. And Bob Junedef and John Mullen will come up in just a second and say a couple words.
Terrific.
And I wanted to add, too, if you have any questions on the program, the program director, Sarah Kendall, is in the room and can answer any questions.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I'm very glad to be seeing you again, and I'm particularly happy to be here today to talk about something really positive, and that's work incentives. Our organization runs a program that provides benefits planning services to people who are on Social Security. And these are services that are designed to help them to understand how the rules work so that they can return to work and protect their benefits or perhaps move past their disabled status with the federal government and get off of public benefits altogether. I've given you a very quick outline of how that works and some of the factors that are involved and a couple of stories of clients for whom the service has been available. The difference between us and WIN is primarily how we're funded and who we cover, because even though we do coordinate very closely with WIN, we can only serve people who are on Social Security who are looking to return to work. I'm going to make this very brief, but what we have found is that individuals who have been found disabled, who are on SSI or SSDI, want to remain productive. Under the old way of looking at things, when we first put together Social Security Disability and SSI, the idea was that a person was either able to work or disabled. If they were disabled, they were considered to be never to be able to work again, and the government was basically dictating that they remain unproductive and dependent. Or a person was not disabled and they're on their own. What we recognized over time is that people can be productive, that people with disabilities can be, and that we're starting to explore gradations in terms of allowing people to work, to be productive, to earn income, to supplement what they're making, and while not risking their benefits during that process, so that a person with disabilities who absolutely relies upon, for example, medical services, does not have to put their health care at risk in order to go to work and to try to be more involved in society. Perhaps someday we will solve the health care problem that we face in America, but right now it's just a stark reality that we send the signal through our complex bureaucratic systems that people have to be afraid in order to go back to work and be productive. These programs are starting the first steps in addressing that problem, and they're extremely valuable. And so I'm here to tell you that we have seen these successes, and we urge you to continue to support them.
Thank you, Bob. If we're not using the machine anymore, maybe it can be turned off. I think that's sort of an annoying sound.
It will get louder before it gets quieter.
So. Just turn it off?
I think it's off.
I think Keith is. Are you handling it? That's okay, Sherry. Keith is. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. First, let me say what a pleasure it is to be here today and to recognize the great work of Sherry Stock, who was a member of one of my advisory councils in Clackamas County, where I first became acquainted with her, and the good work that she's done on so many things this session, including all of the brain injury work that she's done in this discussion this morning. It's also a pleasure to be here at the invitation of Representative Gilliam, who I miss on this committee. It was always great fun to have him on this committee, but also I appreciate the fact that he had this thoughtful consideration of having this discussion today. And I want to thank you too, Madam Chair, for putting together a really great discussion this morning on a number of things, and it's in that light that I want to provide a little bit of context, and I'll be very brief, although I'm going to start with President Franklin Pierce, who's probably very much on your mind these days. he and Dorothea Dix had an argument of sorts about the role of the federal government when Dorothea Dix wanted to have land grants to open up hospitals at the state level, and what he basically said in vetoing a bill that was approved by Congress was that he didn't see any role for the federal government to be the great almoner there's a word you don't hear very often, to provide assistance to people that had needs. We've come a long way. It took really actually until we got to the Depression before there was very much in the way of services from the federal government. But along the way, we've done a number of things at the federal level that Bob talked a little bit about, and I won't go over those grounds about what happened with Social Security and so forth. But I do want to talk a little bit about what we've done in the state and put a little bit of context around this. The program that we're talking about today, the WIN program, is just an excellent program. At the same time, we've done a number of things that have had some unevening effects as far as people with disabilities is concerned. You know about the elimination of the General Assistance Program, the Medically Needy Program, the services for people with disabilities in the long-term care system. We also eliminated a very, very good program, the Employment Initiative Program that we had in place for a number of years was eliminated in 2005 that helped to get people with disabilities that had benefits back to work. So in putting that context on that, I just also want to say that during this session, we've had a number of discussions about things that are very important. We're, of course, trying to reestablish general assistance, and we have good discussion here on House Bill 2051. We also had a good discussion on House Bill 2887, which is people with disabilities that get SSDI that have a two-year waiting period for Medicare. We also had the excellent discussion around House Bill 3065, and it was Representative Olson's bill that was brought forward that we took a look at bureaucratically. We were spending so much money to send out very small checks, and we provided the context to say, what are we really trying to accomplish here by supplementing people that have very low income and also for the special needs that they have? So in closing around this, again, I just think this is excellent work, excellent program that we're talking about today. And I would hope that during the interim we have an opportunity to put some things into context about how we can make some additional steps forward as far as people with disabilities are concerned. And a postscript I'll add to that is one that I've talked to Representative Tomei about at some length, is about where we're heading on our whole healthcare discussion and what is happening with the changes that will happen with House Bill 2009 and 2116, and what happens to the Department of Human Services as it breaks into two major parts, and with mental health and addiction services going to the Health Authority and other programs, the Seniors and People with Disabilities and CAF staying in the Department of Human Services. We have additional challenges of making sure that we don't take additional steps backwards about people with disabilities and their needs and the whole array of people receiving human services, but that we focus on ways in which we can improve those services, improve connections at the state and local level. And so programs like WIN are the way that I would like to see us go in the future. I think it's a terrific idea, terrific program. The independent living centers do really terrific work. But I want to have us at times return to the context of what we're trying to accomplish for people with disabilities, because I think we have many things that we can talk about this session that were achievements, but also there are places where we've, again, taken some steps backwards. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might make one last comment, which I forgot, which is that I would like to, I just want to note the work of Molly Sullivan, who has worked in our office and has worked with the state on this project, and I can't praise her anymore than she deserves, because she's done a great job on this.
Is she here today?
She's not here today, well, but I did want to just note.
Send her our best wishes.
Thank you.
Okay, we only have 10 minutes left. I'm sorry.
10 Sherry. Minutes?
Yes.
So as people come up, you're not going to have 3 minutes. You're going to have 1 minute. So if Jamie and Head and Mike Westrich could come up.
And we're so glad that all of you came today. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful walking in this building this morning before 8:30 and seeing you here. We really appreciate you coming down to your state capital. Thank you for coming. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Tomei, Vice Chairs Boone and Olson, and members of the Human Services Committee, my name is Jamie Head. I am a work incentives coordinator with Independent Living Resources in Portland. And again, we do serve folks with disabilities who are working or wanting to work and need to know how to plan for earnings and how that'll affect their specific benefits. I'm just going to cruise through here real quick. This draft bill really would provide a way for people with disabilities to utilize the 13 federal work incentives programs and close to 30 state-specific benefit programs so that they really can get back to work. I've worked with many folks with disabilities who, for many different reasons, have not had the understanding of the various work incentives. For this reason, they have been struggling, really barely surviving on little income, thinking that this is all they can do. When we share the work incentives information with the consumer, a door is now open. Now they know their options and how they can, in fact, return to work and plan the effect of earnings on their benefits. They're in control now and are able to make those choices that make the most sense for them. And a person in this situation, once they return to work, may experience a wide array of benefits from increased self-worth, increase their networking opportunities, decrease their health symptoms, all of which would save the state money by bringing in tax revenue and decreasing those health care costs. Really, this is not just a goal, but a reality that I have seen with multiple consumers that we have served in the Portland area. I do urge the introduction of this bill, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
I don't think there's a bill in front of us, and maybe that's something you're going to be presenting in the future.
Yeah, we had a draft bill.
Okay.
That didn't end up as a bill this session, is
exactly,
that right? Okay.
Yes.
Okay,
so we'll,
that's my confusion.
Right, and hopefully we can do that in the future. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
So Mike, 1 minute.
Okay. I'll skip around on this letter that I have right now. My name is Mike Westrich. I went on disability 3 years ago, and I only make $705 a month. So I signed up. I was wondering how I was going to survive on that, so I signed up with Vocational Rehab in Tigard, and part of their program had the WIN incentive people there, and they introduced me to the PASS plan on Social Security plan to achieve self-support. And through that, I've gotten grants for $45,000 to start a business, which I'm going to be opening up in a couple weeks. And during the process, I've had four different times when WIN successfully saved me from Social Security trying to cancel my PASS plan. And I really love WIN because they're really easy to get a hold of. It's, let's see, Legal Aid and Disability Advocates had a cut in their funding. When I call them, it might take a couple weeks to get back. When I call WIN, I get them right away. And Social Security listens to them. And I get responses within a few days from Social Security or whoever I'm trying to deal with. I'm working with Goodwill. I got a huge contract with them. I'm going to be hiring 9 people. I project I'll be making $190,000 in the first year. I'm recycling their scrap metal. I would get 170 tons a month from them. I used to work for them. And I looked through everything I wanted to do, and I realized the best thing I could do for myself was to get the contract with Goodwill, work through the PASS plan, and work with WIN. And because of them, I've been able to do that, and I'll probably be successful in what I do.
Sounds wonderful, Mike. We're really happy for you. Thank you so much. Thank you both
good
for
job.
Coming up.
Carol and Cora.
Good morning. Chair Toomey, Vice Chairs Boone and Olson, and members of the Human Services Committee. My name is Carol Simula, and I work for the Lane Independent Living Alliance, or LILA, which is a center for independent living. For the past year and a half, I've had the privilege of serving as work incentives coordinator for the WIN project in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Every day, I meet with people with disabilities who are on Social Security and want to work. I teach them about work incentives, which, by the way, a work incentive is anything that encourages someone to go to work. I teach them about work incentives that allow them to keep their housing, health insurance, and cash benefits while their earnings are low, so they feel confident trying to work without risking their primary means of support. I was trained and certified on the ins and outs of work incentives, what they are, which clients are eligible for which work incentives, how they are used and reported. I've seen work incentives make a huge difference in people's lives. The difference between living in dire poverty and having enough money to get a haircut or buy gas. Without WIN, people find Social Security rules and programs difficult to use and even intimidating. But my colleagues and I make them understandable and useful. Some of the partners who regularly rely on my expertise are counselors at various offices for vocational rehabilitation, social workers and rehabilitation therapists at hospitals, including the Oregon State Hospital, and Housing Authority staff, Northwest Senior and Disability Services, among others. We need to be there for our partners' referrals, or many clients will stop trying to work out of frustration.
I'm going to stop you because I know people are here also from as far away as Grants Pass.
Yeah.
And we'd love to have your material in writing. So the
and
people
is,
from
everything is in your packet.
It
so
is.
When you do your talk just two sentences and that's all.
Right.
That's about 1 minute. So, Cora?
My name is Cora Jones. I work at Lane Independent Living Alliance in Eugene, Oregon. I'm blind. I have used work incentive network in the past, and I also work as a peer mentor advocacy information referral, and I do refer a lot of people to the WIN program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Yeah. Okay, our Grants Pass folks, could we have them right away? And then we've only got a very few minutes. Is there anybody else that's come further away than 100 miles?
Yeah, there's a few. Ontario.
Ontario?
Ontario.
All right, Ontario, we want you next.
Okay. Chair Tomei, Vice Chairs Boone, Olson, and members of the Human Services Committee. My name is Nelson Ferguson. I work with Hassel and Independent Living Center as a work incentive coordinator. I served over 400 clients last year in the counties of Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine. Simply put, this program enables disabled persons to make informed choices about going back to work. The clients that I have worked with have gone back to work and gained self-esteem. But by working now, they pay taxes, contribute to their communities, and have also lowered state costs and food stamps, Oregon Health Plan, and other benefits, thus saving their state monies. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for making it short.
Hi, my name is Michelle Davis, and I've been disabled with mental health issues most of my life. I'm a survivor of child sexual assault and domestic violence. I never thought I could get a job. My medications, I need them. And without them, I'm in the hospital and you guys spend more money on me. So I realized after talking to Nelson and getting in the WIN program that I can work and give back to the community. I'm an asset to the organizations I work with. And I went from jumping when the phone rang and now doing multitask phone calls. I mean,
that's great. Good for you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for coming today to tell us your story.
Thank you.
My name is Buddy Zeezer, and I'm from Grants Pass. And I just want to let you know it's an honor and a privilege to be here in the state capitol, and I want to ask you to give your support and funding to the WIN program because, to tell you the truth, they saved my life. I was on a mission to kill myself with either alcohol or a handgun, and through that program, they literally saved my life. So I just want to let you know that, and that's why I'm here.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for coming, and we're glad you weren't successful in that endeavor, but you're successful in this one.
Okay, Ontario?
Orca.
Ontario's coming.
And well, I know it does.
It does indeed. While those folks are getting settled, I hope everyone else realizes that your presence in the room, whether we hear from you or not, is really important because it gives us a feel for how many people are supportive of programs like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've come from hundreds of miles away. It means a lot to us. It means a lot to us. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Buddy Mendiva, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Bonet, and Olson. In 2007, on Memorial Weekend, I was in a four-wheeler accident, leaving me paralyzed from the chest down. It was a life-changing situation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was going to provide for myself, my son, or move on with my life. With Jennifer and with the WIN program, they've given me a future. I'm now getting ready to open up my own dental lab. I'm working for five different dentists and making a future for myself.
That's great. Good for you. Is this the little guy who knows you?
Oh.
Hi there.
Oh. This is bodyguard right here.
Yes. I've been watching him suffer through all this talking. Good job.
Thank you for
Thank
coming.
You.
And thanks for bringing your son. And we're so happy for your success. That's great.
Hi. I'm Jennifer Bonnell, and I am from Ontario. I work for Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living. I'm a work incentive coordinator. And the main thing I want to share is how this program has brought me to tears three times. The first time when I was in training, and I started crying, wonder what I was thinking taking this job. The second time was when there was funding issues, and I thought I was going to have to tell my clients that had been with me from the beginning, as well as future clients, that there was not funding for WIN services. The third time was when the client shared that he had started his own business and he would not be there without WIN services. And so I just want to share that with you and thank you for considering us and keep us up there for.
And he brought tears to our eyes too. Thank you. Okay, one last person and then we really have to go.
We're going to have Trudy wrap up.
Just real quick, we have a LC Concept 3755. If you want, I can send you a copy of that through email. Thank you very much. You'll be hearing from us about pending legislation.
I hope so.
I would like guidance from the committee on when you think we should do that. I know there's a session in February. I don't know what the possibilities of that are yet, but if you could be in contact with us to let us know on that.
And would you contact my office?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Okay, so that's all we have time for. But what I'd like, if you are one of the recipients of WIN services, would you please stand so we can acknowledge you? That's great. Thank you for coming. Thank you. And best wishes to you. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Trudy. With that, I'm going to take my Kleenex and go home. No, I'm not going home. I'm going to go to a very important meeting. But with that, I will close the informational hearing on WIN, and I will close the Health Committee on Human Services. Thank you.